Hey.
Yes, good to hear you. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing? Busy.
Personally, I'm fine, but other than that, I'm pretty freaked out, I'll be honest.
Well, maybe we can shed some light on it. I have some thoughts today, so let's see what happens.
Good.
Okay, you ready?
Yep.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a privilege always to welcome back the Saker for our quarterly Emerging Multipolar World. There is a great deal to talk about. He's been very busy. His website has been very busy. It's fabulous if you haven't visited. You want to visit the Vineyard of the Saker. And he has a new book and he has a prior book, both of which are excellent and shed tremendous understanding and light on what's going on. I can't recommend them enough to you. We discussed his book last time. You can listen to that in the archives. And, of course, today we have the Drumbeats of War. So, Saker, welcome to the Salier Report, and thank you for taking time from an explosive website and a very busy schedule.
Thank you for having me. It is always a pleasure.
How is the book doing?
Well, the book is doing fine. It's going at a steady pace, so I'm very happy with the result.
Well, there's a review up at Salieri, but why don't you just give us 2 minutes and tell us about the book and how we find it?
The easiest way is to go to my blog at thesakerinoneword.is, which stands for Iceland. And then on the right-hand side, you have the colons where you can order my book. The first one is now for free for download, and you can order the second one. It's called The Essential Saker 2.
Right. It brings remarkable, you know, the multipolar world is complex. It's not simple. And it brings remarkable insight and understanding. Okay, Drumbeats of War. The title of our discussion this quarter is Why Syria? So we see severe multiple personality disorder going on between what the United States says it's doing and what it's really doing. Tell us, bring us to date, what has the United States been up to in Syria for the last 2-3 months?
Well, I think what we need to do to understand that situation is completely separate two realms. One is the realm of what is actually really happening in Syria, and a totally separate realm is what is being presented to the public, primarily the U.S. public, but generally the West, the public in the West. These things don't even overlap at this point in time. So what we have on one hand, I'll start with the latter, the theoretical issue, is disagreements, and we are told that the Western governments are upset by the following, that there is, first of all, ISIS or / Al-Qaeda in Syria. Secondly, that there is a dictator there which is ruthless and kills his own people. And what we are trying to achieve, we being the collective West, is a negotiated settlement and a destruction of the terrorist. Now, I don't know if anybody can actually take that kind of nonsense seriously. When is the last time the West had objections to Arabs killing Arabs? I don't recall any case. What about Muslims killing Muslims? I don't recall any other case. And as for the chemical accusations, we had exactly the same ones with Saddam Hussein and, you know, his stocks of weapons. And then we even had that in Syria a couple of years ago. So all of this is a complete facade, actually pretty poorly maintained. And that's important. The fact that it's not credible is actually crucial for what's really happening. I'll come to that in a second. And now it's even strengthened by another meme or a paradigm that's being, you know, offered to our minds, is that the Russians are basically chemical using evil men. They used chemicals on Litvinenko, they used chemicals on Skripal, and now, well, they're at least not disagreeing with Assad using them on his own innocent people, or maybe even shipping them. Maybe there's collusion, you know, and we're really, really upset about that. That is all absolute nonsense. It has no bearing at all on reality. What's happening in reality is that the United States has completely lost control of the Middle East. That's the first thing to understand. I would argue by an absence of any kind of foreign policy, and that began under Obama, but it certainly continues today. It's different in its presentation, but what we have is a completely dysfunctional president. Again, Obama couldn't do it, and Trump doesn't do it today. Secondly, a number of gross miscalculations by the United States, which made things worse. I mean, the biggest one, I think, of all is the first one, which was the invasion of Iraq, which was really a crazy thing to do considering the impact that that had upon Iranian influence in the Middle East. But there are other miscalculations, and the U.S. is actually losing the control of the situation, whereas the Russians have moved in, and moved in very, very successfully with a very small force. You know, Obama predicted that the Russian economy actually said was already in shreds. He said that if the Russians moved militarily in into Syria, there would be body bags, and none of that happened. And actually, the really small Russian task force in Syria made the crucial difference with the help of Iran, which is essential. They turned the course of the civil war. They essentially allowed the government of Syria to liberate at least most of the urban centers of Syria, and things are not going well at all for the United States. But the problem is not even Syria. The problem is, and it's very, very clear in Western statements, I'll bring two. First of all, the UK defense minister, who in a moment of frustration said Russia should shut up and go away. And then we had a recent statement, I think it was by Mattis, but I'm not sure, but at least Trump, Mattis, or maybe Bolton, one of the three, said that, you know, we have a deconfliction line with Russia, we talk to them, but they don't get to veto what we're doing. And in reality, of course, that's what's really at stake, is does Russia, and not really Russia, but anybody on the planet, get to veto the omnipotence of the world hegemony? That's what's really at the core of it. That's what's so scary. The U.S. can afford, the U.S. doesn't have really vital interest in Syria. Israel does, but unless you assume that U.S. has, you know, a God-given mission to do whatever the Israelis tell them, the U.S. really could, has basically lost Iraq and Afghanistan already. Syria and Libya are in the same process. Frankly, the U.S. can afford that. What the U.S. doesn't want to accept, and I'm talking not about the country or the people, but the ruling elites in the West, is the fact that they don't get to do whatever the hell they want. And that's really what this is all about. This is why, for instance, the Skripal false flag in England is so important. Yes, it is ridiculous. Yes, they have changed their story many times between, you know, the agent that was supposed to be a biological warfare agent that kills with a microgram on the skin, doesn't kill three people who were exposed, and it was first through the air vents, and then on the bench, and then on the doorknob, and then with buckwheat imported. I mean, all of that makes absolutely no sense. They're still continuing. But, you know, it doesn't matter. That's the beauty of it, because the leaders of Europe are declaring that their honor is loyalty. Or, sorry, solidarity. Loyalty was the SS during World War II. Now they say it's solidarity. That's their explanation. We are in solidarity. With what? With a nonsensical narrative? Yes, with a nonsensical narrative, exactly. So that is the key thing, which means forget about international law, forget about logic, forget about facts, forget about anything. The only thing that's at stake right now is, does the hegemony get to do whatever the hell it wants worldwide? And Russia says no. And other countries say no, but they're less exposed than Russia. And the outcome is very, very uncertain, because I'm very afraid that this is not... there was this recent rather pathetic strike that Trump ordered. Yes, the strike was pathetic, but Trump declared it a perfect strike. So, see, facts doesn't matter. It's just the rhetoric. So there's one of two things that's going to happen. Either the facts will eventually catch up and become undeniable, for instance, a military defeat for the so-called coalition in Syria. At that point, the leaders of the West will be infuriated, or they will have to back down and accept the reality for what it is, that they cannot control the entire planet. But I don't think they're willing to accept that.
So let me suggest what I think their strategy is, because the West is now operating on a model which is much more clear than it was 20 years ago. It's not that it's changed, but it's gotten a lot clearer. And that is that their economic model depends on warfare, depends on organized crime. But it's a flow model. The Bretton Woods model depends on controlling the flow. And as long as they can control the flow, they can print the currency. And as long as they can print the currency, price is no object. In other words, they can debase the planet to get more. They can just print it off their printers. They don't, you know. So they will do anything to maintain that power. The power to basically stick the bill for whatever they do to the entire planet. And that's what, to me, that's what this is about, because to maintain that power, you have to control the flow. And as China, you know, if you look at the economics globally, because I think at the end of the day, this is a currency and economic war. The Asia is converging in terms of per capita income, and Europe is the biggest market. And so if you have Asia rising and the per capita income's rising and then connecting directly over to the landmass instead of through the seas to Europe, and if the U.S. gets cut out, then how are they going to maintain the flow? How are they going to maintain the currency? And the thing to understand about their military strategy is they don't need to win, they don't need to be efficient, but they do need to be able to economically bankrupt their competitors. So their goal is to outspend 20-1 until, you know, because I think this is about Iran and Russia not being able to basically satisfy China's needs for energy in a way that puts America out on the, you know, controlling the flow in the middle. And so what they're trying to do with the combination of the sanctions and everything else is basically collapse Russia and Iran economically before Russia and Iran make China so powerful that they lose control of the flow model and the ability to print the currency. I mean, that's what it looks like to me.
Yeah, but the ability to do that is predicated on a number of assumptions which are just not applicable today. The first one is to spend the usual narrative is that Reagan and the West outspend the Soviet Union, which triggered its collapse. That is good political science, but it's actually bad factual analysis, because right now the U.S. does have a military budget that actually is bigger than the rest of the planet combined, but it doesn't result in a useful military machine. That's the key thing to understand. I've been saying it many, many times already, specifically in the Middle East, specifically in Syria. The U.S., Israel, Saudi Arabia coalition, which is what matters, but you can add the Brits and the French to it if you want, does not have boots on the ground, does not have that capability. These countries simply do not have ground forces capable of actually operate against a meaningful opponent. The fallback option was to use high technology, to use airstrikes, to use special ops embedded with friendly insurgents. That's not working anymore either. And even scarier right now, Russia is proving pretty conclusively that she is ahead in key technologies such as long-distance cruise missiles in her defense systems, and I would argue actually even air superiority fighters and submarines while we're at it. So for all these reasons, the notion to make the entire planet pay for the American printing press is predicated on having the ability to, you know, under what it was in the sentence, to beat up a small country every couple of years or so to send a message to the others. The problem is there's no candidates for that left. The countries who represent a challenge to the United States hegemony today are all capable of fighting back. So if you want, you can see the dollar was backed by gold, then by oil, then by aircraft carriers. Now it's backed by nothing. And that's a huge danger for the entire structure of the hegemony worldwide.
So I used to think that it was a problem that the military wasn't efficient, that it would spend, you know, so we have $21 trillion missing from DOD and HUD, $20 trillion missing from DOD over the last, since fiscal 1998. So, you know, part of, and I struggled with this when I litigated against the federal government. I couldn't figure out why they would spend, you know, my estimate was they spent $45 million to, you know, fight with me for 11 years, and it just seemed unbelievably wasteful. And then finally I realized control was the biggest job program. And if you look at the military budget, much of the military budget in this country is designed to buy political support and to get everybody into the model, not to produce a military, let alone an efficient military.
I think the main goal is to actually produce revenue for the corrupt people running the system.
Right.
I completely agree. From that point of view, the perfect example being the F-35, which I consider a stunning success. It's a lame, pathetic, over-engineered piece of technology, but in terms of the financial windfall, it's fantastic.
Right.
The problem is that you can't fight. The system is, again, predicated on being able to frighten and, if need, beat up. We can't do that with that kind of the entire military-industrial complex completely dysfunctional. Thus, it does not produce an instrument that would allow it to continue that policy. With Russia, with 10% of the American military budget, is producing really now, I would say, equal or better, or mostly better, and mostly much better weapon systems, and the training of the personnel, etc., is infinitely higher, contrary to the roaring, repeated mantras of American politicians, you know, about the best fighting force in history and the best soldier and the best trained. That's absolutely utter nonsense. If you actually look at what happens when there is any kind of opposition, you rapidly see that these myths crumble.
So I really want to believe that you're right about that. And here's my concern, because I've spent the last 20 years tracking money disappearing from the Department of Defense, and I've concluded that whatever is going on is very, very different than what is published or publicly known. So in the last, basically in March and April, we have a competition between Putin and Trump. Putin's speech before the assembly and right before the election, and then Trump in San Diego to the military, basically talking about their, new powerful weapons. And Trump, of course, being very mysterious and referring to lots of, or intimating to me, lots of magical space weaponry. And so what this comes down to is technology and advances in the application of technology to weaponry, which are all classified. And, whatever Putin and Trump said, no one knows, what cards are in their hand in terms of weaponry. And so that's my question. What's going on with black budget technology and what's going on in space, and what does it do to this equation? And the answer is, I have no idea.
Well, first of all, most of what Putin spoke about was actually known to military specialists in the West. Not in details, but general, the outline was known. Secondly, really, it was not a message, I think, intended to U.S. leaders and analysts, because for them, even if Russia did not have these new weapon systems, they still knew that even the older generation, I was about to say conventional, not conventional nuclear forces, but nuclear strategic nuclear forces that existed for the past 10, 20, 30 years, both countries, both sides, can inflict unacceptable damage on each other.
Right.
So if you see that, you then realize that Putin was not really addressing those who were aware of that. He was addressing those who were not aware of that, and particularly those in the West who delude themselves that by deploying an anti-ballistic missile system, somehow the West could protect itself from a retaliatory strike. So what he did, he actually, without those weapons, I'm absolutely convinced of that. I don't think anybody ever challenged that. And even without those systems, the retaliatory strike could inflict unacceptable damage on the U.S., just as the U.S. could inflict unacceptable damage on Russia. But the important thing here is to change the mindset of the people, to make them understand that should a war start, they will be affected. No magical weapon system will show up. And that's one problem with the notion that there are secret, technologies out there. Yes, there are. But as soon as you integrate them into a functional weapon system, it's pretty hard to impossible to hide it, because you have to test it. A lot of the testing, even in labs, doesn't provide you what you need. What you really need is tested actually in a battlefield situation, which you do incrementally. And that kind of testing is impossible to conceal. So I don't really believe that there are very many, secret technologies and weapon systems on either side. There are plenty of technologies being worked upon. They're integrated into systems which are on a development level on a laboratory, but they haven't even reached additional operating capability, much less so actually the ability to be deployed on a battlefield. So we're pretty much still left in the real world with what we had 10 or 15 years ago. But again, remember I said at the beginning, you have to completely separate the realm of what really is happening with this la-la land in which the Western public opinion is kept. And Putin attempted to explain to the Western public opinion and politicians, who are not experts at all at these things, that you're quite mistaken if you think your ABM system is going to prevent us from wiping you out if you attack us. That was, I think, the intended message of this. Just in the same way that the use of long-range cruise missiles was a way to indicate to the West, not to the specialists who already knew that, but everybody else, you know, Russia has a much longer reach and more powerful missile than the West has currently. And that is to try to turn over what I think is a very dangerous process, which is we're headed for war. And people here in the West think that they're completely safe, that this is not going to happen. It's not discussed. It's not at all like the Cuban Missile Crisis, where everybody was freaking out, jumping on under tables, you know, duck and cover, and my God, will humanity end? Right now, nobody discusses it, and the situation is far more dangerous. So what the Russians are reduced to doing is threatening now.
I don't think nobody discusses it. In other words, if you look, what is fantastic about the West weapons, in my opinion, is their success at mind control. And mind control is a complex topic. It's not one thing. You know, it ranges all the way from media and propaganda to entrainment. You know, but I think if you look at the technological mind control operation that's been arrayed, part of the problem with the Western establishment is they've had too much success with it, and it's made them overconfident, and that has made them stupid. So
I agree with that, except for I don't think they had that much success. I think it's even worse than that. They covered up their failures, and they got away with it, and they're politically successful in spite of their failures. That's even worse.
Oh, I do. I think the entrainment technology has been wildly successful.
I think it's had a dramatic impact. I know nothing about that.
Yeah, I think it's had a dramatic effect on the behavior and the mentality of the American people. So,
you know, I think buzzwords such as stealth, network-centric warfare, space weapons, buzzwords like that, if that's part of mind control, yes. But there's really nothing behind that. I mean, at least as far as I'm aware of. And that kind of mind control works until you get to the battlefield where somebody actually fights back, and then all of that instantly collapses.
Well, I agree the mind control ultimately has to come up against the concrete, but I have seen, you know, basically if you look at the entrainment that's been rolled out, I was sitting on Wall Street in the 80s, and in 1984 I gave away my TV, and except for a brief period when I worked in the administration, I never had a TV again, because I heard two essentially billionaires talking about the entrainment that was going to be rolled out on TV, and it scared me to death. And one of the most popular interviews on the Salieri Report, I'll send you a copy of the transcript, is our interview with Adam Trombley, who's a scientist on the entrainment that's on the smartphones, on the TV, on the media. And it's very, very significant. And I think part of the arrogance of the U.S. establishment is they've been so successful. I mean, if you can basically steal through the bailouts the equivalent of, you know, 100% of the value of our pension funds. Our pension funds are $25 trillion. The bailouts were, you know, depending on how you count it, approximately $24 to $27 trillion. $20 trillion is missing from HUD and DOD. The U.S. government has never produced audited financial statements. Meantime, people are being economically drained. You know, the general population is having done to them here what the Russians are having done to them. And we're struggling. We're not doing as good a job as the Russians at it. You know, and they've gotten away with all of it. And my sort of history with the U.S. establishment, I'm nowhere near as involved with them as I used to be, you know, is progressively throughout the 60s, 70s, 80s, they couldn't believe that they could get away with it. And the problem is now you've reached a point where their hubris is enormous. But I will tell you, behind the scenes, the covert operations and targeting against people who do things like what I do is very, very significant. So, you know, if you look at the investment they put into control and mind control and the covert investment, it's very, very extraordinary. And unfortunately, so far, what I see, it's working. But it's not working because the American people are stupid and don't care. They're struggling to figure out what they do. And the clear message to them is between voting corruption and financial fraud, et cetera, and the corruption of the court system, they're struggling to find a way to have any impact. They have essentially no vote.
I completely agree with that.
Right.
Totally. And I agree with you again. It's not because they're stupid. It's because they have no option. The system basically is literally dictatorial in a sense, doesn't allow, there's no absolute people power representation, and people are being brainwashed. Certainly the media does a superb job of keeping people ignorant and stupid. I completely agree with that. The problem is that I'm afraid that events on the ground will make it impossible even for the Western media to cover up the reality of failure. And at that point, I am not convinced that the leaders of the Anglo-Zionist Empire would be willing to settle for being a great power in a multilateral world ruled by the rule of law. Because if they fail militarily, when I think they will and are, they will fall back on the last thing which will be left in their arsenal, which is nuclear weapons. Regardless of how dysfunctional the U.S. military is, regardless of how corrupt the military-industrial complex is, regardless of how poorly trained and commanded American forces are, the U.S. nuclear triad is still functional. Enough, for sure, to trigger World War III. And that's all it takes. And I'm afraid that's their last tool.
But I don't think their strategy is to win militarily. I think their strategy is to win economically. So what they want to do is outspend and outlast Iran in Syria and Russia in Syria to the point where the Russians and the Iranians collapse economically or come into submission. So I think their goal is not to win militarily. I think their goal is to win economically through overwhelming military expense.
I understand, but the problem is that this strategy has now very clearly failed. Both Russia and Iran are countries which have not and will not be destroyed or put to their knees economically. And we have even a better case, I think, which is the DPRK. And Putin clearly said that. He said, you know, they're willing to eat grass if needed, but they will not give up on their nuclear weapons. And I think that's exactly the reality that this logic is faced against, is that it doesn't work anymore. The Russians actually and the Iranians basically are forcing the U.S. by not being crushable economically to do what they've done with other adversaries who were resisting them in the past, which is either use terrorism or actual military intervention and bombing. And that's right. Where they're headed for defeat. They don't want, I agree with you that the Western elites don't want a nuclear war. They don't even want a direct confrontation militarily with Russia. The problem is that when everything else fails, that's what they're left with in their toolkit. They're not going to just go, okay, I guess our time is over. That's where I see the danger.
Right. So I think you're exactly right on this, because they thought that Russia and Iran would collapse by now. So if you look at their writings, they thought the collapse would come, and it hasn't come. Something else has happened, and it appears to me that their strategy is, okay, well, then it's a matter of time. We just need to keep this up longer.
Yes, but that also doesn't work. I mean, you have the example of Cuba, and again, the best one, I think, is the DPRK, where sanctions, you know, and mismanagement internally have had a dramatic impact. But the society is still resisting. The country still, you know, has what it takes to fight back. And therefore, that's to me the perfect symbol. But they're not going to achieve that with either one of any of these countries. It's just not going to happen.
It's really interesting. Did you see Lavrov's interview on the BBC?
Yes, I did.
Okay. So the same thing happened to me that happened when I saw what happened with the fires in California. It's the second time in my life I've ever gotten nauseous looking at world events. But Lavrov struck me as extremely competent, very intelligent, and arguing for the rule of law.
Yes, absolutely,
and
agree with you.
The Anglo-American Alliance felt like a bucket of slime. And
yeah, but it's worse than that, Catherine. It's worse than that because, you know, Anglo-Americans. Yeah, how about Macron? He's pathetic. I mean, he's truly pathetic. And look at the rest of the Security Council, with the exception of Bolivia, you know, who basically refuse to condemn the U.S. for breaking U.N. Security Council rules. It's pathetic. It's all. It's not just the Anglo-Americans. The entire West is just slime and absolute total moral corruption with hypocrisy elevated to stratospheric heights. And that's what's so scary again, is that now facts don't matter, decency doesn't matter, logic doesn't matter, and even the rule of law, which is, you know, one of the greatest intellectual achievements of the Western civilization now, is just flushed down the toilet in ridiculous fashion, and nobody cares. That's what freaks me out.
Why do you say nobody cares?
Because I see, 200,000 people going to Washington, D.C. to protest the Second Amendment, which is an achievement, I would say, in civilizational terms. And now we're risking, 100 or 200 million people dead in 48 hours. And I don't see demonstrations in Washington, D.C. I get individuals who write to me. Some people do care. But the general public has been so zombified that they're not realizing how dangerous the situation is right now. We could have had a nuclear war if those strikes in Syria had happened differently. We could have not had a USA and Russia, as of today. We were that close. That's that past Sunday.
Well, that's interesting. I thought we were, I would not have said we were that close last Sunday. That was my guess. But we were certainly on the way there.
Well, I was driving back through the Ocala National Forest when I got a telephone call of a friend who told me Trump has just gone on national TV and announced that he's going to punish Russia and Syria. And I just went, oh my God, because what I visualized at that moment was a strike on the Khmeimim air base, which would have been followed. I mean, the scenario is just so simple. Let me just restate it. Strikes or attempted strikes on Russian forces. Russian forces shoot back and would shoot, of course, at the carriers. At which point, look at Trump with his bigger red button and all his rhetoric about a perfect strike. Do you really think he would accept that there would be actual losses impossible to conceal in the U.S. armed forces? He would have to escalate. Wait, let's just look. Bear with me with a simple couple of steps. He would have to then retaliate again. And the Russian contingent in Syria is small. It's technologically superior, yes, but just by numbers, CENTCOM and NATO can overwhelm them. The only help for them can come from Russia, which means the next strikes would be cruise missile strikes from the Black Sea, the Caspian Flotilla, and the Russian Air Force. Where do you think Trump will strike back to punish the Russians for that? On Russian national territory.
So first we see a tweet from Trump. I forget when it was, 2-3 weeks ago, basically saying, okay, ISIS defeated, it's time to leave Syria. So he's saying, I want to get out of Syria. Well, the next thing you know, we have a fake chemical attack and Trump getting cornered into having to look like he's doing something about it. Now, if you listen to the discussion with Lavrov, what I heard, and I'm guessing, is that the military of Russia and the United States got together and said, okay, we have to look like we have retaliation. What can we bomb that won't hurt anything? And, you know, and the whole thing was like a coordinated. So we had a staged chemical attack and then we had a staged retaliation that was specifically designed to not make things worse for the Russians than the whole, staged reality, had to make it.
True. I think it's exactly what happened. I don't know if Mattis deserves the credit that some people give him, but clearly the U.S. strike, the Americans went out of their way to not even appear to be striking Russian forces or Iranian forces, for that matter, which are always forgotten, or even Syrian government facilities that matter.
So if you look at what was going on coming up to that moment that they had this staged, it's almost like a false flag retaliation.
Yes, you know, no, there were several. There was an attempt to hit the Syrian Air Force, though. There was an attempt to destroy part of the Syrian Air Force. So it was not that benign. But what's really critical is I agree with you. There was an effort made by the U.S. side. But look at the outcome. The outcome is really pathetic, which is the majority of missiles were very successfully intercepted, and crucially, not by the Russians. So technically speaking, when the Americans say, we saw no activity from the Russians that didn't shoot down any of our missiles, it's technically true because that was done by the Syrians.
Right.
But now, he can speak of a perfect outcome, but the outcome is pathetic. That's the problem. And it's going to become, you know, it's sort of seeping into the consciousness. Most people, I don't think, buy this, not a single missile was hit, when there's cell phone, you know, video from Damascus seeing how those missiles are actually shot out of the sky. So,
okay, so,
how are we going to not escalate after that? Tell me that.
Well, here, let me just bring up one other thing. And I know we don't want to talk about the administration, but I think if you look at the events coming between Trump basically saying, great, time to leave Syria, and, you know, all of this phony baloney stuff, if you look at the attempts to squeeze Trump or his family, they have been off the charts. And the question is, you know, if you look at those kind of squeezes over the last 20 years, those kinds of squeezes happen, and then suddenly after the American politician gets squeezed, you know, something happens that's pro-Israel. And, you know, the reality is, I think at this point, Israel is using criminal means to affect and control American politicians and the Congress and lobby America. And it has a role in this, which is really very criminal and very venal and very, very dangerous, because you're talking about basically the ability to blackmail, manipulate, and control people who've got their finger on the nuclear button.
Yes, I completely agree with that. But you mentioned Israel. Let me mention one thing just to sort of put a rein on the parade of the withdrawal. I remind you that Israel announced a withdrawal from Gaza and then executed it. And look what kind of quote-unquote withdrawal that is. So when Trump says we're withdrawing from Syria,
right,
it absolutely does not mean we're leaving Syria alone and we're done with it.
Right.
Plus, it contradicts the plans of breaking up Syria in several parts. It contradicts the Israeli desire to have a Kurdistan at the north. I'm not a psychiatrist or psychologist. I think Trump has no idea what he's saying. He's saying one thing and then the opposite, the next tweet. I'm at the point where I stopped listening to him entirely. I don't care what he tweets next, because I don't think it has any bearing on what is actually happening. And that's really a sad statement to make, because I think he's irrelevant in the equation right now.
Well, there's no doubt, for a variety of reasons, I would say that America is going mad. And part of it is, when you can print as much money as you want to do whatever you want, and there's no check and balance that brings things back to what is productive or what is healthy, you can get way, way off track. And that's what we're watching. We're watching a society that will do anything to keep the power to print, and it's getting beyond, you know, it's going
mad.
Yes,
I agree. I completely agree with that. And right. The scary thing for me is that, mad as this society is, it still has a functional nuclear triad.
Right. Right. Well, I would say it has a nuclear triad, and it has lots of other dangerous weapons as well. And that makes the situation extremely dangerous, because, you know, it is clear the economic model is now dependent on operating outside the law. So you have a criminal enterprise. It's exactly what happened in 2001. I went to Congress to try and get my company paid. The government owed us money, and I was meeting with the chief of staff to the Senate chairman of the HUD Appropriation Subcommittee. And she said to me, "What do you think is going on at HUD?" And I said, I was trying to be discreet with somebody I didn't know. I said, "What do you think is going on at HUD?" And they looked at me dead in the eye and said, "HUD is being run as a criminal enterprise." Now, it's very funny. I said to them, you know, I don't disagree, but what you need to know is HUD is run on a matrix structure and is controlled by the Department of Justice, the Treasury, and the New York Fed member banks and the big contractors. At that point, Lockheed was the number one information systems and payment contract. So basically, the Department of Justice, Lockheed Martin, the Treasury, and the four or five biggest banks in New York controlled HUD. And to run HUD as a criminal enterprise, they all had to work proactively, intentionally to run HUD as a criminal enterprise, which at that point I had concluded they had, because I'd been able to do the research and the due diligence to basically prove that to myself. And, you know, I've written that up. But here's the reality. If Treasury and the Department of Justice and Lockheed Martin and the four big New York banks and the New York Fed are running at that point, you know, $500 trillion of money in the federal government as a criminal enterprise, then the whole goddamn U.S. government is a criminal enterprise.
Exactly. I was about to say it. I think it's no, I mean, I absolutely believe you in what concerns HUD, but and this goes for the Pentagon, the CIA, and the entire government. That's why the rule of law inside the country can be completely ignored, or outside. I mean, Guantanamo is a typical example. But, you know, the way, for instance, just one topic that I like, the way the Second Amendment is being deconstructed by means of regulation is also, you know, a violation of law, and nobody
right.
really cares. The surveillance of American people, how about, you
Please
know,
don't say nobody. First of all, I'm not nobody, but there are there are millions of people who care and are doing a great deal. Now, they don't get on CNN, but that is a war that is being fought in the trenches. I live in Tennessee. More than 50% of the active voters in Tennessee belong to the Tennessee Firearms Association. Mm-hmm. And you should see the war on the ground here over that issue. It's
okay. I don't want to sidetrack, you know, our right. conversation into the Second Amendment discussion. But here in Florida, we had one Republican guy in a committee in the Florida Parliament block something just by his own person. That was, we were supposed to have a vote on, the majority of the people, of the members of Congress here voted for it. He blocked it by just basically not even having a vote on it. And there was no political outcry here very much outside specific circle. I agree. Some people are aware of it. But do they have an impact? Not really. They're still, you know, the same people are sitting in positions of power, and they're still continuing to basically breaking the law.
Well, here's what this comes down to.
I agree
to.
That people are opposing and they're protesting,
right.
but I think they're not achieving anything. Let me rephrase it this way then. And not by their fault, but by the fault of a system that's evolved successfully to basically completely function as a criminal enterprise, and successfully so.
Well, here's the thing. The system is economically dependent on criminal enterprise. So this gets back to, I don't know if you remember my red button story. But you have to be willing to push the red button and say, no, I'm not going along with criminality. And that means financially, you're going to have an implosion. You know, but that, frankly, you need an implosion to get from something which is a downward spiral. It's like a body, you know, our economy is like a body dependent on drugs. We're dependent mm-hmm. on narco dollars and war dollars and all these other things.
Yep.
And we're going to have to go, whether we go cold turkey or we're going to evolve off of it, you have to kill that addiction to get back to the rule of law. Because the question is, are we going to die of our addiction to dirty money, or are we going to have the rule of law? Because you can't have both. It's one or the other.
I completely agree.
Right.
I completely agree. And I think a lot of people who voted for Trump really thought that he would be the one that would allow us to gradually change the system and not go cold turkey or, you know, or crash and burn, but operate what I was hoping would be what I call a soft landing.
Right. But the pigs are out. The pigs don't want to survive an implosion. They don't know how to manage an implosion. They don't know how to get, you know, nobody knows how to get from here to there. And that's frankly why I think having an honest conversation about all of this is so important. Because the only way we can figure out how to get from here to there is to call out the problem for what it is, which the politicians, including Trump and the major media, are not going to do. So somebody's got to do it.
Yeah,
and that's
I agree
why I
with
think,
you.
Right.
And
that's
I think
why
you and I are both trying to do that. But
yes.
We're fighting against multi-billion-dollar media holdings who, you know, can outspend us a trillion to one.
Right. But I think we have, you know, because I'm a great believer that ultimately this planet and what happens will be determined spiritually. And I don't think, because I think this is spiritual warfare, and what we're up against is literally demonic.
I agree. Completely agree with you.
When I watched Lavrov speak, I said, you know, I don't know what team I'm on, but I'm on his team.
Yes. And you know how many people write that to me? I mean, I always mention that, but I think the real level of popularity of Putin in the U.S. is actually very high. And what I hear very often here in Florida is that this guy stands up for American values.
Right.
Really?
Right. Well, you know, I remember during 2016 driving around in Memphis, Tennessee, seeing Putin for president.
Yeah, bumper stickers. I've seen them, too. I've seen them.
So
it's true. I actually agree with that assessment. I think this is what's happening. We are having a – and here I would actually see a Marxist thing. We're not having a geopolitical competition between two countries. I think we're having a class struggle between the different classes of people. And one of these classes would be the, you know, the oligarchs, transnational oligarchs, whatever you want to call them, the bankers, the financiers, the people who basically got wealthy and ran the system for all these years versus the rest of mankind. I see that actually as a class struggle.
Here's what's so interesting. I have two businesses. So since 2008, I've been an investment advisor. I'm phasing that out to just do investment screens, but I've been dealing with individuals. And then in the Salieri Report, I have readers and then paid subscribers. And if you look at people who are reading and interacting with me, they range from homeless people who interact mm-hmm. with me through the library, the computer at the library,
yep,
but they're homeless.
I have those too.
All the way to people who are fantastically wealthy. And all of them hate what's going on. All of them want the rule of law. All of them are prepared to push the red button, and it has nothing to do with class. It has to do with people who understand that values, you know, price is useful, but it's not values, that values have to rule and control, or else nothing has any meaning and nothing has any value. In other words, therefore the law, and therefore a fair fight, whether it's in the marketplace or political or whatever. They really believe in freedom, and they believe in human – they want a human future. And it's got nothing to do with class or how much money they have. It has to do with fundamental intelligence and grounding and spiritual understanding. You know, it's like they're all connected to the divine intelligence, and the other people are completely lost.
I agree with you that, you know, class analysis and the notion of class consciousness – you know, can be exaggerated and end up meaning ridiculous things such as your income defines, you know, your political views. But I do think that there are classes in our societies that are maybe with fuzzy borders. And let me tell you why I come to that conclusion, because what's happening today is clearly orchestrated. But I don't believe that there is, you know, a boardroom where the chiefs of the conspiracy meet, make their plans, and then execute them. I think what's happening is that there are people who have a stake, if you want, collusion,
right,
towards certain policies. And these people, I call them a class. It's not, doesn't mean that it's the wealthy against the poor, but I mean that there are those whose basically entire worldview and consciousness is defined by their position in that hegemony that we're all suffering under.
I totally agree.
Similar to what the Soviet Union had with the nomenklatura,
right?
Formalized that class.
Right, it's sort of a corporate version of the criminal class.
Yes, and that's what I would call. I'm not really a Marxist. I'm just saying it's
right.
Important to see that we have a collusion, not a conspiracy. Because if we look for the heads of the conspiracy, we won't find them.
Right, I think you can find them in sort of organic ways, but. So let me tell you a story. I was out at the Aspen Institute for a conference last September and had a sort of interaction with a guy who's very, very wealthy venture capitalist, and he's from the software industry. And he looked at me with, you know, like complete certainty and said, look, we can replace every job in America with software, robotics, and AI, and that's what we're going to do. And it's destined, you know, get out of our way. And that's the thinking. In other words, it's the Karl Rove quote. We have the technology to do whatever we want. We can print money and we're going to do it. And it doesn't matter what you think because your reality is no longer operating. You're just an observer.
We will create the reality we want. Yes, exactly.
Right.
I agree with you.
And we're prepared to liquidate the rest of you. In other words, they're prepared to liquidate the rest of humanity. I don't know if you saw Sean.
Yes.
Sean Parker's right. So Sean Parker said, look, I made money getting kids addicted to Facebook, and now I'm a billionaire, so I'm going to live to 165. And, you know, in Silicon Valley, we're all going to do – he didn't discuss this, but you know, Tucker Carlson did. We're all going to get children's blood and give ourselves therapy and, you know, live for 165 years and we can afford to do it, you know, because we got you all addicted and it worked. Ha, ha, ha.
And see, here's the problem. That kind of messianic delusions is nothing new in the West. It has existed in the past.
Right.
And it often ended up with Russia having to burst their bubbles and bringing them back down to reality. But the problem is nowadays, the delusional folks have, again, I'm coming back to that, it's my obsession right now, a nuclear triad that can function. Hitler didn't have that. The Crusaders didn't have that. Napoleon didn't have that. These guys have it. This guy that you met that says we're going to replace everybody with AI, his people, not him personally, but his group, those who are in solidarity with him, have a functional nuclear triad. How do we prevent them from destroying our planet now? I don't know.
It's a big... Well, there's one way that I know. So right now, I did a big study for the annual wrap-up on the state of our pension funds. So if you look at who's financing this whole thing, it's our pension funds. We have $25 trillion of money in our pension funds, and we are the biggest buyers of U.S. treasuries. So this is how it works. The pension funds have bought trillions of dollars of treasury. The money goes to the government, and then if you look at government finances, it disappears out the back door. So imagine you're financing a company and you have a bond of that company, but the money is disappearing out the back door. The owners are taking it out the back door, and so your company's empty. Okay. So the U.S. government has become a vehicle to launder money, real money, out of the pension funds and disappear it into the corporate black budget infrastructure. Now, the pension funds under the law can't permit that to happen. That is a violation of all sorts of fiduciary obligation. And the minute the pension funds say, you know something, we're not going to buy treasuries anymore, game's over.
What would be the consequences of the people who would take that decision in the pension funds for their careers, families,
well,
et cetera?
If one of them did it, the same thing that would happen that happened to me. They'd be targeted, they'd be poisoned, they'd be harassed, their car would be run off the road, they'd
exactly.
get electronic harassment, all of that stuff, if one did it. But if they did it all over the country, if you had 1,000 do it or 2,000 do it, they don't have to stop buying treasuries. They just have to start asking questions.
Correct.
So, you know, you need 1,000 to 2,000 to do it all of a sudden all over the place.
And you believe that that could happen?
I believe it could happen if enough people were willing. You know, but here's the thing. You have to look at the economics of this because we're waging an economic drain, not just against, you know, the global world and the Russians and the Syrians, but the economic warfare is against the U.S. too. So let me give you an example. The net neutrality laws. I was trying to figure out, because the corporate infrastructure was trying to get two things done. One was to pull in the guns, and the other was to kill net neutrality. And so
Correct.
My question was, what's this is about? Well, as soon as they kill net neutrality, the first thing that happens, my website gets – I published the pension fund study suggesting, okay, maybe we ought to pull the plug through the pension funds. My site gets hacked. I'm down. And suddenly AT&T is blocking everything. In other words, all my subscribers who have AT&T and related AT&T, you know, from the merger's domains can't get emails from Solari. So this has gone on now for 2 months, and we've done all sorts of things. You know, we move our mailing server, bam, the block moves. We've contacted senior people at AT&T. They've looked on their inner system and say there's no block and you're clean as a whistle. There's no reason for a block, you know, and me having to tell them, apparently you have a super crypto block you don't know about. And finally, what I did, I've written two articles, one a recommendation to our subscribers that they're going to have to move their email because we can't communicate with them if they're on an AT&T ISP, or if they have an AT&T email, it looks like there may be ISP, you know, and connection problems too. It's not as clear. Anyway, so that's all documented. But I sat down with my attorneys and I said, okay, my subscribers, I've got 58 subscribers who have paid for the Solari report, and their AT&T is not letting the information through and is not telling them. is this not tortious interference, whether with me or their subscribers? And they said, no, now that they've torn up the net neutrality rules, if you look at what the FCC has done, this is all perfectly legal as long as they can justify it under their terms and conditions. Now, this is just the beginning, because after the election, my prediction is, you know, the telecommunications networks will be used to basically take the rest of small business income and suck it right up into the big corporations. It gets back to what the guy in Aspen said to me when he said, you know, we're between AI and you know, software and robotics, we're going to suck up all the income and all the jobs. So net neutrality is designed to basically micromanage anybody's knowledge or access at a very, you know, at a one-by-one level. It's what it looks like to me. Anyway, the second article I wrote was on net neutrality and the fact that my congressman, Marsha Blackburn, was the chair of the subcommittee that let this happen, as well as letting the ISPs give away your web browsing history data. And what's interesting is Trump won Tennessee by 26 points. Marsha Blackburn right now is down 10 points in the polls. She's got billboards all over her district saying, you know, talking about what she's done here. And what's interesting is Oregon and Washington have now passed net neutrality bills, and there's a huge fight out in the California legislature because they're trying to pass a net neutrality bill. And it's you know, I'm beginning big question mark. Have we finally figured out, you know, that either we fight back? You know, we're all in the same position as the Russians here.
Yes, we are. I completely agree with you.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right. So we're all, you know, the American people are having the same fight that the Russians are having. And what we're all trying to figure out is how do we organize to support the rule of law across the board? And how do we
have the same enemy. I agree.
Right. Well, we have to. Here's the problem. The financial dependency of the American people and the American allies on the criminal enterprise is enormous. And so you have to figure out, okay, how are we going to evolve, you know, one household and one community at a time, our economic model? Now, can I just take a minute and scare you to death?
Please. I'm already there, but you're welcome to make it worse.
Well, I've been having a huge war with a whole bunch of people in the independent media because they're all promoting what a great idea it would be to abrogate the debt or fire everyone in the government or dissolve the government and auction off the remaining assets. And what they don't understand, what they're promoting is they're promoting doing the rape of Russia here. Either, you know, I think it's after either this election or the presidential election. But they're organizing to say, hey, wouldn't it be great if we dissolved the U.S. government and auctioned off all the... I mean, it's basically the rape of Russia plan. And
do you really see Congress passing a law dissolving the U.S. government?
No, but I see a corporate infrastructure very hungry and desperate for more profits. I see a group of politicians desperate to get the capital gains they get when the corporate profits go up and their stock prices go up. That's how they make their... I mean, the Congress gets their political contributions from capital gains that result from real estate rising in value and the stock market rising in value that all comes driven by corporate profits. So Congress has become a corporate profit delivery machine. That's part of what tearing up net neutrality is about, is using surveillance and access to people's data and their flow to scarf up the small business income so that it now becomes corporate profits. You have corporations all around the world who are getting clocked. You know, we all went global and made lots of money in the emerging markets. Now they're coming back because local competition is killing them and the margins are shrinking. So they need more profit in the U.S. and the politicians. I mean, that's what the whole Marsha Blackburn fight is about. U.S. politicians are making money delivering it to them. And so will they do these kinds of things? Yes, because we have used digital technology to re-engineer basically corporate functions. But all the re-engineering we could have done to re-engineer government, we haven't done. And the corporations are now coming in using that as an excuse to say, oh, government's not efficient. We can make it efficient, just privatize. So David Shukin just resigned from the VA, warning that you got a bunch of nimnuts running around basically proposing to privatize the VA in a way that will be horrible. But this is happening in every area. It's happening in, you know, mark my word, it's either after this election or after the presidential election. They're going to come in and they're going to try and say, government's not efficient. Let's bring in corporations. They can run the schools. They can run the military. They can run the this. They can run the that. And the question is, you know, in addition to trying now, you know, to pay the corporations to do something, it'll be more expensive, not less. But what you can do is you can transfer lots of government land and real estate and assets at below market to keep the corporate game going. But you need to keep the taxes coming. So you need the governmental function to work to boss people around and keep the taxes going. And that's where the rubber is going to meet the road. I mean, I think the rape of Russia is coming here.
It could be, because there are certain parallels. And when you speak about, you didn't use the word voucherization, but basically breaking up the government, that's what was happening in the 90s. The Treasury, you know, Treasury had people there, and as did state and CIA, was basically helping completely steal the wealth from the country. It's absolutely true.
Well, let's before we end, I just wanted to say a few words about Ukraine. So we've talked about Syria, and the reality is the same game is still being played out in Ukraine?
Yes and no, because in the Ukraine at least, I mean, this is not much of a consolation, but I don't see U.S. forces directly involved in the coming war. And since U.S. NATO forces will not be directly involved, there's less of a risk leading to eventual use of nuclear weapons. But will there be a war, and will it be bloody? Probably yes. Everything is in place for it. They've been working on it for a long while. Again, never say never, but I would say the probability of a Ukrainian offensive this summer is sky high.
And what would a Ukrainian offensive look like?
It would be massive, and it would rapidly, I mean, depends on your working hypothesis. I mean, there's basically two scenarios possible. Say the good one is that the Nova Russians are successful in, they're 3-1 to 7-1 disadvantage for them, but they have better training, morale is infinitely better coordination there. So they're a tough bunch. If they manage to stop the Ukrainians, the West will say, aha, look, Russia intervened again. And never mind facts, never mind that it was done by the locals. They will say, look, at the size of the Ukraine army, are you telling us that just the Donbass by itself could win? That's impossible. The Russians have intervened. And all the stuff we've heard for all these past years would just be repeated at a higher pitch level. But there's a much scarier scenario, which is say the Ukrainians are successful. They actually managed to break through the Nova Russian defenses. I don't think it's likely, but I don't think it's impossible. At that point, Russia would have no option but to intervene, because
right.
The plan that the Ukrainians have is to do what the Croats did in the Serbian Krainas, or what the Albanian Kosovars did in Kosovo, which is occupy and ethnically cleanse. And Russia cannot allow that, which means that Russia would have to move in militarily. Now, the war would stop very rapidly at that point, because the Ukrainians don't have a chance to against the Russian military. But think of the political consequences. For the
right.
First time, the Russians would really be there. They would actually say, yeah, we're there, we intervened. So everything that's been alleged would become true overnight. That's the neocons, you know, dream come true, because NATO would find a justification, because then, you know, the rhetoric after that. If they intervened
right.
in Crimea and in the Donbass, next they're going to invade the Ukraine, attack the Baltic state, invade Poland, invade France, and go down to Portugal. You know, that's what we're going to be told. And NATO will be immediately, you know, back in power. The Europeans, forget the Brexit. The Anglos will be, again, in full control, as they basically are already, thanks to Macron, of continental Europe. You know, and it's going to actually create a very dangerous situation that will be to the West's benefit. The scariest part of it all is that there is no risk really for the Anglo-Zionist Empire to trigger that war. You know, Ukrainians and Russians killing each other, who cares? It's like Arabs and Muslims. That's just cannon
right.
fodder. So the human cost of such a war would be irrelevant to them. The political outcome is a win-win situation. That's what's so scary.
Well, you know, I have to needless to say, it's going to be a long, hot summer because this is far from over. And if it escalates, it could go very, very wrong. So the situation is dangerous. Yes. I do have to say on a positive note how grateful I am to you for everything you've done, because I would never be able to understand what's going on there. You know, the whole Eurasian world is a very complex world and it involves many different cultures. And the advantage of reading your website and then reading those two books is I get lots of information about a complex world and the cultures that I don't have access to otherwise. And I feel like I'm finally beginning to get my mind around what's happening there. But without your information, it would never have been possible. So
thank you. Very kind. And that's, I owe that to all the many, many, many people who helped me throughout that and are still helping me.
Right. Well, it shows you how many people really are interested in the rule of law and believe that the truth matters.
Yes, there are. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, well, before we go, any last words on what's up for the next quarter?
Just a big question mark. War, no war, and if war, how big? I am extremely pessimistic. I hope that we meet in the next quarter, and by some wisdom of Putin, or by the grace of God, things don't look as bleak as they look now. I really hope so.
I hope so, too. So, time for some prayer.
Yes.
Saker, have a wonderful quarter. We look forward to talking to you next quarter. Thank you for everything you do. You're just an enormous blessing to us and to the world.
Thanks for your kind words. You're very kind to me. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.